Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be speaking with Jenny Ashford about her new book, The Unseen Hand. And this is an absolutely fantastic book compiling a variety of poltergeist cases. It's almost 400 pages, or around 400 pages. And it just, it divides it up into sections, and it deals with some of the very well-known cases as well as a bunch of not-so-well-known cases, and gives you a great overview of just how diverse this phenomena can be while still retaining some sort of pattern in there. So I'm going to be talking with her tonight and probably next week as well, because there's just way too much to talk about in this book to squeeze it into one show. So it's going to be a minimum a two-part show, maybe even a three-part show, depending on how next week goes. As soon as I have next week's ready, we're not doing this all at once as I sometimes do, but as soon as next week's is done, I will be making it available to Patreons. You can become a Patreon at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Click on the Patreon link. It's only $3 a month. You get extra stuff. You get multi-part interviews as soon as they're ready. And bonus stuff, giveaways, and things like that here and there. All right. So with no further ado, this is my conversation with Jenny Ashford. All right, Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you very much for having me back.
Now, this is your fourth book on the subject of poltergeists, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And this one is longer than all your other books combined.
Yes, it is.
And that shouldn't scare people, because your other ones were, you know, not super long books.
Yeah, I mean, the other ones were kind of, you know, bite-size, and they, you know, just mostly described one case. But right. This one, I was super ambitious and decided I was just going to talk about every case I could find, so.
And it runs in around the 400 page mark.
Yep.
And it is a fascinating review of this stuff. It really is. You've done a fantastic job.
Well, thank you.
You have such a diverse array of cases. I mean, there are certain things you see in a lot of the cases, but then you have ones in there that are very high strangeness type of things.
Yeah.
So one of the first things I wanted to ask you is how you define the paranormal.
How do I define the paranormal? I mean, that's kind of a hard question. Really, because I'm coming at things from a largely skeptical point of view, I don't even know if I would equate like paranormal and supernatural as being the same thing. Like supernatural, if something is supernatural, meaning outside of nature, I don't think it can exist. But paranormal, I kind of feel like paranormal, if it exists, it's just something that we don't understand yet, you know, that it can exist, but, you know, not, you know, like maybe aliens, you know, maybe there are no aliens or intelligent aliens rather, but maybe there are. So, you know, in a way that's still in the paranormal camp because we don't know yet. And I feel like the same thing with, you know, poltergeist phenomena and anything that falls into that kind of gray area where, you know, there could be something to it. We just don't know exactly what it is yet.
Right. Yeah, I think the dictionary definition of supernatural is a manifestation or event attributed to some force beyond scientific understanding or the laws of nature.
Yeah,
and I mean they're similar terms, really.
Yeah. I guess I just made a distinction between them.
Yeah. Paranormal really does mean just that we don't understand what's going on yet.
Yeah.
So. The you know, a lot of these cases could be tagged paranormal now, but 50 years from now, we may go, well, that's not paranormal. We know what was happening.
Yeah, we know exactly what was going on.
It's like if we brought a cell phone back to the 1800s, they'd go, ooh, paranormal.
Right. And that's kind of what I was thinking of, too. It's like, you know, hundreds of years ago, electricity would have seemed paranormal to them because they didn't understand how it worked. So I feel like it's a similar kind of thing. And I'm not saying that everything that falls into the realm of paranormal now is going to at some point be proven to be true. I mean, some of it might not be, obviously, sure. But you know, some of it, I think there might be something to it and we'll discover it sometime down the line.
So let's go through the stages of a typical poltergeist encounter.
Yeah. Okay, so basically, and I got a lot of this from Steve Mara and some other parapsychologists that I worked with in the past. They generally put poltergeist phenomena into a stage, and they don't all do this, because there are exceptions, and a lot of them don't go to like the extreme of like the final stage, but a lot of them do, or they kind of happen in this order. Now, usually you have your stage one, which is just real minor stuff where it's like you're not even really sure if it's paranormal yet. And it's usually kind of like knocking on the walls or like kind of funny noises and stuff like that. And, just that kind of thing where you wouldn't necessarily attribute it to anything paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the second stage, which is kind of more like, this is kind of where, well, it's probably something paranormal, because at this stage you're getting objects starting to move, either disappearing and reappearing in places, or you kind of see them levitating or whatever. Stage two would also involve electrical malfunctions, like your appliances not working correctly or things like that. And usually at this stage, if there was rapping or knocking or scratching at the walls, it'll get louder and louder. And stage three is what they call the apparitional stage. And that's where you'll start seeing things, and not necessarily in poltergeist phenomena. They don't usually see ghosts, quote unquote. Every now and then they do, but usually it's just some kind of like amorphous kind of figure, like strange shadows or like strange mists or things like that. Like balls of smoke and stuff. Now, at stage four, this is where the phenomena is starting to directly interact with like the people, either by like biting them, hitting them, pushing them, things like that. Usually most poltergeist infestations don't progress much beyond that. But there are two more stages. Stage five, which is called the incubus-succubus stage. And that's kind of akin to stage four, but it would involve, sexual assault, essentially, on the people in the environment. And the most famous case of that being the Doris Bither case, obviously, on which the entity was based.
Mm-hmm.
And stage six is what they call the possession stage, where it seems as though the person has been taken over by another personality, if people of a religious bent would call a demon possession. But parapsychologists tend to think, well, maybe the poltergeist phenomena can mimic something that looks like a demon possession. And if that's what it is, then that's the stage. And that is usually the most extreme case, where you're getting like a person who seems to be taken over by an outside entity.
Right. Okay. And the difference from hauntings is, there's different types of hauntings as well.
Yeah.
You have the kind that just kind of repeat, that people pick up on or things, but you don't necessarily get poltergeist activity in the hauntings.
Not necessarily. And there are some cases that that have some crossover. Usually I would think hauntings would kind of be categorized in two different things. You have like your quote unquote tape replay type of haunting, where it's just kind of the same, people are seeing the same thing over and over again, which, it's not intelligent or interactive or anything like that. But then you get people reporting other types of hauntings where, they said, I saw a ghost of, a relative or something like that, and it talked to me and told me information and things like that. Poltergeist phenomena, I think, it tends to be more based around a living person. It tends to be more, it doesn't have a message to convey. It doesn't have, any information to impart or anything like that. It's basically just energy reacting. It doesn't really seem to have a purpose. So I kind of feel like poltergeists are probably just some sort of outward manifestation of people's emotional states. And in that sense, I don't really feel like it's an outside entity per se, even though it may appear to be in some cases.
Right. Right. So let's talk about some of the things that happen in poltergeist cases. Like when objects are moved, a lot of times no one sees them actually get picked up, but they'll see them once they're in motion.
Yeah, which is very strange. It's very, very, very rare for anyone to see an object actually lifting off, you know, of a tabletop, say, or disappearing from an area. It is almost always, oh, I noticed it when it was still in flight. I saw it out of the corner of my eye, which I guess isn't that hard to understand because, you know, it's not like you'd happen to be staring at an object, you know, when it happened to decide it was going to fly off the table or whatever. But I kind of feel like maybe there might be an aspect of maybe it can't move when someone's looking at it. Maybe it has to be kind of out of the corner of your eye. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
Yeah, I think maybe looking at it sort of, you know, suppresses it in a way. But, you know, yeah, it's very unusual for anyone to see something leaving. I have heard in a couple of cases people said they actually saw something pick up off a table, but it's very rare. And another thing that's interesting, too, is that when objects move, one thing that's really commonly reported is that the object will be warm when it's picked up afterward. Not always, but in probably 95% of reports, the object is warm when it's picked up afterwards. And sometimes, too, it tends to either make more noise than it should or less noise than it should. And this happened in the House of Fire and Whispers, the Keith Linder case that I wrote the book about. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing that happened was that a little plastic light fixture flew off the wall and hit the floor with a really loud sound, much louder than it should, because it only weighed a few ounces.
Right.
So it really shouldn't have made that loud of a noise when it fell, but it did. And it was recorded and analyzed and everything like that. It had the exact same sound signature as it would have if it was a quieter noise, just the amplification was much more. And another thing too is that, and this happens a lot in cases where of like stone throwing, where stones fall from the ceiling and things like that, the stones tend to fall softly. Like they'll hit people, but it won't hurt them. Or, you know, they'll just kind of float to the floor and things like that. So there's all this kind of weird, unnatural movement reported in these types of things. I'm not really sure why that should be, but I found when I was writing about a lot of these cases, it's very, very, very common.
Yeah, yeah. And the warm stones always interest me because, well, a lot of this stuff, if you look at people hunting for Bigfoot, they encounter a lot of this stuff in the wilderness. They'll get the knocks. They'll get stones thrown at them that are usually warm. You know, things. They'll find figures and stuff made. I mean, it's enough that Joshua Cutchin, one of my regular co-hosts, has coined it the wilderness poltergeist.
Yeah, and it could be. I mean, it does happen outside sometimes. Or like in all the cases I wrote about, it's very rare. But there were some. There was actually one in Brazil where it was just like a particular stretch of road. And these people were just driving along the road, and all of a sudden just rocks and sand started come flying at them from all directions.
Yeah, talk about that one a little, because that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's like I had really never heard of that before. But yeah, it happened. I have to look up in my notes here because I don't remember.
Yeah, fine.
Remember the exact year that it happened. But yeah, so it happened in Brazil, and I believe it was a man and his wife. I think they had just gotten married, I believe, and there was a couple other people in the car. There was a doctor who was a friend of theirs, and more than the man's mother or something like that. And they were driving from São Paulo, and there was just this one stretch of road, and they were just driving, and all of a sudden, like all these rocks and sand started coming flying at them from all directions and things like that. And, you know, first thinking, so they stop the car, they get out, they look around. I mean, the driver had a pistol, so he was, oh, I'm going to shoot whoever is out there. Now, the pistol jammed, it wouldn't work. And they actually drove into town and found a police station and brought the police back. And then the police car started getting battered with rocks and sand and stuff like that. And they looked all around the area and they couldn't find anywhere where this could be coming from. And like I said, it was coming from kind of all directions at once. So it wasn't just like one person chucking rocks at them. And, you know, they couldn't really figure out what was going on. And then finally they just said, well, we don't know what to do. So they just kept on going. Now, as they were leaving, the driver, the man who was driving, said that that something felt like it was hanging on his door, trying to open his door, like while he was trying to get away. And the weird thing about that was that reportedly, you know, once they got out of that area, you know, it didn't happen again. No one else reported it on that particular stretch of road. It was just that one car. And later on, he said that the driver reported that he couldn't find any damage on the car from all the rocks and the sand that had hit the car, which you think there would be.
Yeah.
Find any of it. So, yeah, so that was really kind of a strange, that was one of the very few cases I found where it was outside.
Not only that, but it was kind of a one-off. There didn't seem to be a focus to it.
Yeah, it's just kind of like, oh, well, this one stretch of road suddenly just decided had a little poltergeist outbreak just for no reason whatsoever.
Oh, yeah, that definitely qualifies as one of the high strangest ones.
Yeah.
One of the other things you talk about, and I know when I had you on with Steve Miro, we talked about this, that these things don't seem to like infrared. They don't seem to like cameras in general, but particularly infrared cameras.
Yeah, they really don't. And, you know, I know that that people that are skeptical of this type of thing will be like, oh, well, you know, that's convenient because nothing will ever get captured by camera or whatever like that. But, I mean, a lot of parapsychologists will say that it's very, very difficult to catch anything on camera, on tape, on audio, on anything. But usually they seem to have a particular hatred for infrared. Not sure why. Maybe they can. I mean, Steve Mara has told me, I don't remember if he said it on the show, but he said that he's like, maybe if these things are entities, maybe they can see it. Maybe it hurts their eyes, or maybe, you know, for some reason, he's like, I don't know why, but they really don't seem to like cameras. And they, and you know, in the House of Fire and Whispers case, you know, the, whatever it was, which actually seemed like a combination of poltergeist and intelligent haunting, it stole a couple of Keith Linder's cameras, and it also would turn them around to face the wall all the time. Almost like it didn't want, you know, and if you heard a noise like that was recorded on the camera, you would never see anything like on the picture because it would have turned the camera around, almost as like it didn't want to be seen.
Oh, it definitely has that trickster sort of thing going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
For whatever reason. So let's see. Let's talk about the Fox sisters, because this started a lot of the spiritualist stuff. Now, you pretty much have them down here as being a hoax. Now, do you think that they were always a hoax, or like a lot of poltergeist cases, do you think they eventually became a hoax because the activity calmed down?
Yeah, see, that I'm not really sure about. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, it's pretty much a given now that it's like, and they came out later and confessed that, you know, we made the noises ourselves with our toe joints and all this other kind of stuff. Could it have been? I mean, it started out when they were very young. You know, could it have been they were faking and then it became real, or it became real, or it was real and then it petered out, like you said, and they, you know, that's a possibility, because I do think that, that sometimes, and we might have talked about this in the last show, that sometimes, especially when the real stuff isn't happening and there's so much pressure on the focus to perform, as it were, then yeah, they'll start faking because they're afraid that the real stuff won't happen anymore.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's the case with the Fox sisters. I mean, they did seem to come out later and they said, you know, even from the beginning, you know, the first noise that they claimed that they heard, that their mother actually heard, they said, oh, we made that by, you know, tying a string to the stem of an apple and banging it against the floor, you know, so their mother would hear it from downstairs. So they did seem to be, if their confession was accurate, they did seem to be saying that we were faking it all along. You know, whether they were or not, because there was so much controversy about, you know, the two that kind of went on with spiritualism, and then the other sister, Leah, who there was like a big rift in between them. And you know, the two Fox sisters that confessed, they did actually get money for giving a demonstration of how they had faked things.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's entirely possible that, you know, I tend to err on the side of, yeah, they were probably fakes. But, you know, there's no way of knowing if maybe that it had started out, you know, as a real mediumship type of thing. And then it kind of spiraled out of their control and this whole religion started around it, and then it stopped. And so they felt like they had to keep faking it, you know, so they wouldn't get into trouble, or they wouldn't lose face, I suppose.
Okay. So the first main section in your book deals, is it stone throwing first? Yeah, stone throwing first. Then you deal with cases of knocking, which is very, very common in poltergeist encounters. And the Fox Sisters, of course, one of the knocking cases. But you also deal with the case of Eric Waters from Andover, England in 1974 that I found really interesting.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, let me find it.
Yeah, that's fine. I don't expect you to remember these things right off the top of your head.
Yeah, because it was so many cases. That was the thing. It's like, initially, I had 50 cases in my initial outline. But it seemed like every time I researched one case, I kept finding a bunch of other ones. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. And I never heard of that one, so I should put that one in there, too. So then I ended up having like 120 or something. The book was only supposed to be half this long, but, you know, I kept finding new stuff. But yeah, the interesting thing about the Andover case, and this started out, this is pretty much classic poltergeist. It's two girls or two young women, a 20-year-old and a 12-year-old, and they shared a bedroom. This was in 1974, and they started hearing rapping on the walls. And they kind of thought it was neat at first. I mean, they thought it was, they're like, oh, it's our little knocking friend. And it would knock every night before they went to bed and stuff like that. At first, they thought that maybe it was just like the neighbor making noise, or, you know, maybe they were just knocking the little code with their neighbor or whatever. But yeah, it turns out that that probably wasn't what it was, because one of the little girls decided to test this. And she says, well, I'm going to ask a question of this knocking thing really, really quietly, so that like even her sister in the next bed couldn't hear. And then I'll see if it answers the question correctly. And it did. So after that, they figured, well, it can't be the neighbor, because if, you know, if the sister in the next bed can't hear it, then obviously the neighbor can't hear you through the wall,
right,
and like answer your questions. So, you know, like I said, I think at first it was the Andrews family was the family that lived there. And they didn't particularly think anything of it. They just kind of thought it was neat. But they established a code, as a lot of people did when they had rapping poltergeists. And this poltergeist claimed that its name was Eric Waters. So they started asking him questions and asking him to make predictions and things like that. Like, I think the dad would even... he would even go to the horse races, and he would like ask Eric Waters, what horse should I bet on? And then like, have him I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right. But, yeah, so this Eric Waters knocking spirit, said that, you know, as you do, he said that he had died and was buried under the floorboards. And of course they could never really check anything like that. But so at one stage, like I said, they were asking him questions, they were doing all this other stuff. And then a few weeks later, the knocking started getting more aggressive, and it started getting really loud, and it was keeping the family up at night and stuff like that. And eventually it got to a point where it was so loud that people down the street were hearing it, were complaining, and stuff like that. So at this stage, they decided to call in a paranormal investigator. Now, Barry Colvin was the guy that came in to investigate, and he pretty much right away established that Teresa, the 12-year-old girl, was probably the focus. They said that it was very rare for the knocking to start when she wasn't laying in bed. Now, you know, obviously they have to discount the possibility that, well, she's laying there knocking on the wall when no one's looking at her and it's just a prank. But you know, they did test with her. They had, quote unquote, Eric Waters knocking in other places. Like, can you knock on the headboard of the bed? Can you knock over here and stuff? And he did do that. So they determined that it probably wasn't the little girl doing it. Now, so it seems like as it went on and as the investigation went on, it seemed like Eric Waters was getting more angry. And one of the sons would start yelling at it and things like that. And so let me see, hold on a second. Yeah. So one of the sons started calling the spirit a liar. I don't really believe you're buried under the floorboards. I don't believe you. I don't believe you're who you say you are and stuff like that. And in a way it made the spirit angry. Like, he just kept knocking and knocking and knocking. But also it was kind of good because, you know, the paranormal investigator was there and it kind of gave him something to work with. But, he actually said that at times the knocking was so loud that he could go outside the house and put his hand on the wall outside and he could still hear it. So it was like a booming more than a banging.
Hmm.
And he did a series of tests where he would hold up cards where only he could see them. And he did a few tests where no one could see them. Like, he would just pull a card out of the deck and just not let anybody see it. And then he would ask Eric Waters, you know, what number was on the card, and he would knock it out. And almost always he got it correct. So, that had to be some kind of paranormal something because, you know, no one could see the cards. Even the investigator couldn't see the cards.
Right.
So it had to be something. I mean, I think it was like 17 out of 20 times he got it correct. And like on some tests, he got all of them correct. So it was almost perfect accuracy. Now, they also asked if they could photograph him. And the knocking spirit said that they could. And he even like conveyed through knocks where he was in the room. But when the investigators took photographs where Eric said to take the picture, there was nothing in them. So, you know, whether he was just messing around or, you know, whether he couldn't be photographed, no one knows. But nothing came out on the photographs. And the creepiest thing to me about this case was that the family asked him, well, do you have anything else you want to say or something like that? He told them, I have this message that I want to tell everybody. And he knocked out this message. And the message was, I am here to rest and stop my bones from rotting. Hmm. Which, what does that mean? I don't know. But that was the message that he had to convey. And that was almost like one of the last things that he said. He gave that message, and then that was like his final statement. It's just, there was a couple little minor knocking incidents after that, but that was pretty much the end of it. And, you know, the investigators still kept coming and stuff like that. But at that point, you know, they couldn't hardly get him to, sometimes he wouldn't knock at all and stuff like that. And, after the knocking had stopped, the paranormal investigators decided they would look a little bit into the history of the house and the history of the area to see if there was anyone named that around there that had died. They did discover that although Waters was a very common name in that area of England, they didn't find any of the records that were named Eric, although there were a couple that their first names weren't recorded. So, you know, not completely definitive. Yes, there could have been an Eric Waters and stuff like that, but, you know, and obviously they couldn't really dig the house up to dig underneath to see if he was under there. But they couldn't really find anybody named Eric Waters in the record. So they don't know if that was actually a ghost, whether it was a hoax, whether it was a manifestation of the little girl's emotional state. You know, who really knows? But it's weird because it didn't really progress into anything beyond that. But the knocking was very intelligent. You know, it could tell the numbers off cards. It knew things. Although some of the predictions it made about about the horse races, and I believe they asked it to predict the FA Cup final, or he got that right. But the horse race one, he was only about half and half on that.
Hmm. I'm actually surprised nobody did dig up the living room floor to see if anyone was buried.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, I mean, I would think if I lived in a house where there was all this knocking and it was supposedly intelligent, said, hey, I'm under the floorboards and please help me and all this other stuff, I think I would kind of want to dig under there and see.
Yeah.
I can see how maybe they couldn't, and maybe it wasn't their house, or maybe their other things intervened, but I think I would want to know.
And why is it, do you think, that so many poltergeists adopt the personality of a spirit? Like they try to sell themselves off as a spirit.
I kind of feel like, and I could be totally wrong on this, but I kind of feel like my hypothesis is that I think there's some kind of give and take between the poltergeist energy, for lack of a better word, and the focus individual and the other people in the environment too, to a lesser extent. So I definitely do think there's like a kind of feedback loop of, we think this is a ghost, therefore it behaves more and more like a ghost. And then it just starts building up and building up. And that's why I think that a lot of cases of so-called demon possession are probably poltergeist infestations just happening in an environment where the people who are witnessing it think it's a demon. And right. If you think it's a demon, then the person that's generating it internalizes that and says, oh, well, it's a demon. So they make it act like a demon.
Yeah. Yeah. Unconsciously.
Unconsciously. Yeah. They're not doing it consciously. But so I definitely think the same thing happens with one that acts like a ghost, and even ones where people have seen apparitions and things like that. I definitely do think there's a thing where if you think it's a ghost, then that's what it's going to act like.
Yeah. And I would tend to agree with that. Although, Red Pill Junkie, when we were talking about this at one point, did suggest that if a spirit wanted to intervene in this world, they might use someone's latent psychic ability to do it.
Oh, yeah. I definitely think that's the case, too. And, like I said, and we might have talked about this before, but like in the Enfield case where Janet Hodgson was appeared to be channeling that man, Bill. Mm-hmm. who was a real person who had died in the house and died the way she said he did. I don't know if that was necessarily the ghost of that guy coming back, or if she just had some kind of psychic connection to the past and she was just so it was coming out of her own head, maybe.
Right. Yeah.
She somehow knew that and was like generating this. Maybe it's a distinction without a difference, but
picking up information about the environment.
Right. Yeah.
And you had one case in here, and I didn't write down which case it is, where it seemed like there were two focuses because things would happen when the two of them were around.
Yeah.
But I don't remember which case it was, but I've had that experience. Actually, there's one person who, if she's around, electronics will go nuts around us. It doesn't happen to her. I get limited poltergeist stuff here and there, but it doesn't happen to her. But when she's around, it amps up.
Yeah.
So you definitely can have a feeding off of other people where energy just kind of like goes up.
Yeah. And I mean, I definitely do think, because like I said, I mean, everybody, I do think that poltergeists are generated by, you know, extreme emotional trauma, you know, kind of repressed emotions, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that if that was the case, that it would be a lot more common. So I definitely do think that there's an aspect of the environment and an aspect of the other people around. I mean, it definitely has to be, have all these factors kind of have to align for poltergeist activity to take place. I mean, you know, there could be a person that had latent psychic ability that were undergoing emotional trauma or whatever, but if they weren't in an environment of other people who could somehow amp up their energy, or an environment that could somehow amp up their energy, then maybe nothing would happen. I think there have to be a lot of things to kind of come together, you know, like a perfect storm type of thing, for anything like that to happen. And that probably explains why it's so rare, because it's rare that like this perfect synergy of things all come together at the same time.
I also wonder how much the environment itself, like it seems like there are certain areas that are more prone to poltergeist activity. I noticed in your book, there's like certain areas that repeat, not the exact area, but the general location.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, I kind of wondered about that too. It's like, I didn't know if it was because people in those areas are more likely to report them, or if we just hear about them more because, you know, a lot of them were American or European. Mm. And, you know, since we're Western and that's Western, so, you know, maybe we would relate to it more. And actually, that was one thing I kind of wanted to explore. If I ever do another volume of this, I wanted to see if I could find more poltergeist cases from other cultures to see if there was this kind of similarity. You know what I mean? So yeah. I don't know if it's something to do with the location, if it's something to do with the culture, if it's something to do with the way it's reported. But I would be interested to to delve into that a little bit more, because, you know, most of the cases that I wrote about were cases that had been written about in English. So even though I had some cases in there that happened in Africa, that happened in India, you know, I had a handful of those, but, you know, they had to have been significant enough to be reported into English so I could research them. But, you know, so I don't know if it's something to do with particular locations. Like I'm thinking in terms of there were two cases that happened in England in houses right around the corner from each other, you know, like 20, 30 years apart. And even though the manifestations were kind of different, I would kind of wondered if there was something about that particular area that made poltergeist more likely, or if it was just a total coincidence. You know, it's hard to say because it could be either thing, really.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's see. I also, just as a thought, wonder if more people actually have minor poltergeist activity, but they just don't notice. Like, things go missing, they just assume they misplaced it. Objects move, and they just assume it fell. And so it never really gives power to the poltergeist itself, and then it just kind of stops.
Yeah, so that, and actually, I think, you know, Tom and I have talked about this before. I said, do you know, it might be a lot more common than we think, but people just might be, it might just be so minor that people are just attributing it to, oh, I'm getting forgetful, or I'm getting old, or something like that. Because, I mean, we've had some, you know, unabashedly poltergeisty things happen at our house. Not anything hugely major, but it was obviously, there was obviously no natural explanation for it.
Right.
But then, on the other hand, we've had some things happen that were kind of like ambiguous. Like, you know, he'll be working on something and he's like, I just put a wrench down, and then 5 seconds later I turned, it wasn't there, and then he couldn't find it and things like that. So was that a poltergeist, or did he just leave it somewhere else and forget? It's like, you never know, really. It has to kind of really be in your face before, you know, before you'll attribute it to the paranormal. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it could be really, really super common and people just aren't noticing it. So it's not getting into that feedback loop where, oh, there's a ghost in here, or there's a poltergeist, where it kind of gets the fear and the energy to kind of build up to something worse.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about Matthew Manning, the poltergeist boy.
Okay.
And this was 1967. It's on page 122.
Oh, thank you. Because I have I have my book open, and you know, so, and I have like the little pages that I'm scrolling through because I can't remember what page I'm. Matthew Manning, yeah. This kid was, you know, if his claims are genuine, he is actually one of the very, very, very few people that said that in later years he was able to control the poltergeist and the poltergeist manifestation to an extent. Because he actually, as he got older, he kind of became a sort of a spiritual advisor type of thing. But, you know, same thing happened with him. It started when he was 11 years old. So, you know, very typical there. It happened in 1967. And it started with pretty minor stuff. You know, just things moved around, you know, like this little stein that we had up on the shelf. Now it's over here. This bowl of flowers was on the table. Now it's on that table. So, you know, at first they didn't think anything super strange, but, you know, it kind of got to a point where it wasn't every day, but it was so weird that at last the Matthew Manning's father kind of asked some people at Cambridge University about it. It's like, you know, stuff's moving around in my house. And it's like, do you guys have any explanation for that? But they kind of just blew it off. Like, whatever. We don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
So the odd thing was that this little object movement thing started and then it stopped. Like, all the activity stopped for about 3 months, or they didn't really notice it anymore. You know, so, and then it did, and then it didn't really start back again until a few years later. And at that point, Matthew was 15 and they had moved to another house. So, you know, at the old house, it was just like a couple little things moving, but suddenly years later, they moved to a new house and all hell broke loose. I mean, all the kids' beds started shaking and furniture would lift up and fly across the room. You know, hammers would fly up the stairs. a broom flew up the stairs, you know, things like that, just banging and crashing all the time. So, you know, at this point they called the cops, which is kind of funny. I always thought that was kind of funny, but you know, if you're in that situation, what else do you do? You know,
yeah.
We need help. Let's call the police. And then the police get there and they're like, what do you want us to do? It's like, you know, so that's, this is not our bailiwick. We don't know. But, anyway, it happened that one of the cops that came there, obviously they couldn't do anything, but one of the cops said he knew somebody that was interested in the paranormal. So he referred them to somebody at Cambridge University who was into that kind of thing and could investigate. So the thing with this is the man that came to investigate, Dr. George Owen, he actually never saw anything taking place. He never saw anything moving. He never, you know, so he didn't directly witness any of the phenomena, but he did see like the aftermath of things. Like he would look into a room and then like a minute later, he would look back into the room and stuff would be moved around, you know, when he knew that he hadn't seen anybody in there.
Right.
So, you know, even though he didn't see anything directly, he did see the result of some kind of, you know, activity that appeared to be paranormal. Now, the most kind of notable aspect of the Matthew Manning case was that writing started appearing all over the boys' bedroom walls. And it was usually signatures. Some of the signatures were of famous people, some of them less famous people. And this would happen even when Matthew was not in the room, because when Dr. Owen was there, like a lot of times he would rope the room off and not let anyone in there. He'd make everyone go outside the house so he could be sure that no one was in there writing on the walls. And then they would come back in and there'd be new writing on the walls. And it seemed that when they actually checked some of the more recognizable signatures, they actually did match known signatures of those people. So why, you know, why signatures? I'm not really sure. But Matthew was, you know, insistent that he was not doing it, but he also wasn't having a good time, you know? So I kind of feel like he probably wasn't faking it because he didn't really get anything out of it.
Yeah.
While it was going on, he didn't like to be in the house. He thought it was unpleasant. And, you know, he would go to school. He would leave for school very early and he wouldn't come home until much later on. And they actually sent him to a boarding school later on. But unfortunately, the phenomena followed him to the boarding school.
Of course.
So, yeah. So some of the students with him actually reported, you know, beds moving by themselves, a pile of plates flying around, puddles of water, you know, just appearing, you know, knives, bricks, stuff like that, you know, kind of turning up in the dorms. And this was witnessed by, he shared a dorm with several other boys, almost two dozen other boys. And so they all reported this. And it turned out that Matthew found out that he could stop the manifestations by doing automatic writing. And he says he came into this quite by accident, that he was writing an essay and he kind of spaced out and started writing without thinking about it. And after that happened, there were no disturbances that night. So he thought, oh, well, maybe I'm, you know, I'm channeling things into this writing, into this automatic writing, and so it's not acting out in this other way. So once he started deliberately channeling things into the automatic writing, you know, the objects flying around and stuff like that, that all seemed to stop. Now, while he was doing this automatic writing, he would kind of, you know, he would do, and this is pretty commonly reported too in automatic writing cases, where he would produce handwriting that didn't look like his own. He would produce writing in other languages that he reportedly did not know. And he could also do drawings that appeared to be in the styles of very famous artists, Paul Klee, Leonardo da Vinci, Pablo Picasso, things like that. And he would sign them with those artists' signatures. And reportedly, these drawings looked very much like drawings by the actual artists. So you know, there's obviously, just like in every case on this, there's kind of, you know, two sides. A lot of experts that have looked at the signatures that he produced and the drawings that he produced said, yes, they do look very much like the original drawings of the artists, and look a lot like the signatures of the people that they're supposed to be. And, you know, he has detractors also, but, you know, as it went on, as he got older, he sort of learned to control his powers a little bit, and he could do similar things to, I guess, to what Uri Geller got very famous for doing on TV, stopping clocks and things like that. And he could also reportedly produce objects from thin air. But he is now working, and as far as I know, he's still alive. He's working as a psychic and a healer. And he wrote a book called The Link about his childhood. But he's not a real, he doesn't ever appear in the media. Like, he has private clients and things like that, evidently, but he's not turning up on all the talk shows, like doing tricks or anything like that. So, you know, he seems to live pretty quietly.
Yeah, I found that one really interesting because he seemed to get a grasp of it.
Yeah, and that's very unusual, because I feel like, you know, people that are focuses of poltergeist activity, I almost feel like you can't control it. Like, there might be some kind of mechanism in your brain that's preventing you from controlling it. Like, you have to allow it rather than control it. And so I think there might be some kind of thing where you can't, or it's like, it won't work if you try to control it. Because, you know, if someone could actually control it, I mean, you know, that would be like Firestarter or the Fury or Scant, something like that. It would be like that. I mean, that'd be awful. So, so it does seem like, and really him and, Don Decker, the Rain Man, who also claimed that he could control his, the indoor raining to some extent, but, that's kind of really the only two cases where it seemed like they actually got some handle on their quote unquote power and learned to kind of channel it or control it later on.
Okay. Let's look at Enfield. Okay. Now, a lot of people are probably familiar with Enfield because of the movie about the Warrens, despite the fact that the Warrens didn't seem to have much of a role in it.
No, they did not.
we'll get to the Warrens later.
Yeah.
Let's go over Enfield, because a lot of people, I don't think, know the true story, because they've been kind of poisoned by The Conjuring 2, which has very little to do with what actually happened.
Yeah, and that's kind of a shame, because the Enfield poltergeist, I always found, was really one of the most fascinating cases in its own right. And it does seem like every time they make something out of, like, they made The Conjuring 2, they also, the BBC also made a three-part miniseries based on it. And although the first two parts of that stuck fairly close to the real story, the third one, it just kind of went full on horror movie.
Right.
And the actual case was really not like that. I feel like, well, you know, the Warrens were kind of the main character of Conjuring 2, but they did not really have anything to do with Enfield. They apparently, according to Morris Gross and Guy Lyon Playfair, who were actually on the investigation, the Warrens turned up uninvited one day and were only there one day, claimed the whole thing was a hoax, and then took off, and they never heard from them again. So that was pretty much the extent of their involvement.
Well, if I remember right, too, they said something about Ed Warren was trying to explain to them if they played it right, they could make a lot of money at this.
Yeah. And, you know, not to crap on the Warrens, it's just they, well, particularly Ed Warren, I think, was, you know, he was kind of in it to make some money.
Yeah.
And, you know, whether he thought he was helping people, I think he probably was. But, I think they were kind of in it for the money, especially him. I'm not so sure. I'm not sure about
Lorraine.
Lorraine, because, you know, she seemed like a nice lady. But I don't know. Ed seemed more kind of like bullying his way into cases and being like, yeah, we're going to write a book about this and they're going to make a movie just like Amityville and all this other kind of stuff. Because, you know, they got involved in Amityville, too, after.
But
yeah, the thing about Enfield is that a lot of the manifestations, and, you know, this is pretty, it's kind of like the classic poltergeist case. It was a family where it was a single mother. You know, her husband had taken off and left her with four children. Two of the girls, Janet and Margaret, were about, about puberty age. And started out similar kind of thing, knocking on the walls. That actually, I think the first thing that happened was a dresser kind of scooted across the floor by itself. And the mother actually witnessed that. And as it went on, the only thing unusual about Enfield was how long it went on. And it went on for like a year and a half. And so many people saw it. But I don't know. I feel like it's been so, you know, Hollywoodized and stuff like that. To me, the most interesting thing about it was, and I would recommend reading Guy Lyon Playfair's book, This House is Haunted, because he was there for a lot of the case. And the book is kind of dry, but in a way that sort of makes it creepier because it's very matter of fact.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not exaggerating anything. He's just like, in this day, this happened and this happened. You know, I was hit by a Lego that flew by itself across the room and, you know, and things like that. And, you know, so I think the weirdest things that were reported in that were, you know, Janet's Bill voice.
Mm-hmm.
She said that, that Bill was talking from behind her. And actually, I still think the recordings that Maurice Gross took of her talking like that are still pretty creepy. I mean, even if she was faking it, which I don't think she was necessarily, but they're still pretty creepy to listen to.
Yeah.
And the fact that she could talk like that for hours and hours and hours at a time without losing her voice,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes me think that there was probably something to that. Also, there was a couple of people reported that Janet had levitated a few times. Now the famous series of photographs of her like kind of flying through the air and stuff like that. Now that just looks like she was jumping off the bed to me.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, when I see all the, so I don't consider that levitating. It just looked like she was jumping off the bed. But some people did say that they saw her levitating in the window. And I believe a couple of witnesses even said that she had levitated, she had floated through the wall and had left a book in the neighbor's house.
Hmm.
Then had floated back into her room, so she kind of teleported through the wall. Now that was reported by a couple of witnesses. I don't think that the parapsychologist reported that, but a couple of their neighbors did. But you know, other than that, it was mostly just, you know, funny noises, banging, things flying around, like tables, chairs, couches flipping over, noises like dogs barking when there was no dog. And, you know, things like that. But I don't know. It's just, it seems like, I remember watching, I actually haven't seen The Conjuring 2 yet, but I did see the BBC miniseries about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem like in the miniseries, they made Bill, the old man, almost like the antagonist. And they made him like, he would appear as a ghost and things like that. Now, Janet never saw him. No one ever saw him. You know, so that kind of made me angry that they felt like they had to do that. I mean, she just talked in his voice. Nobody ever saw him as a ghost. Nobody thought it was a ghost or anything like that. But, you know, so, and the thing too is that, again, this is a case where while the girls probably got something out of it at the time, because, you know, they had a kind of a bad home life and their father just left and things like that. So they were getting all this attention, you know, they had all these psychologists and media people, and they were coming and staying with them and paying them a lot of attention. And they probably thought it was cool. And they did get caught faking a couple of things, nothing big, but, you know, I think one time they moved a tape recorder and Maurice Gross caught them saying, we're going to move this tape recorder and say that the poltergeist did it and stuff like that. So I kind of feel like, skeptics say, you know, oh, well, they got caught faking once or twice. Therefore all of it was faked. But I mean, you kind of have to feel like where these two girls were coming from was that, you know, they were suddenly in the center of attention. They had all these people staying with them. They had all, you know, so they didn't want it all to go away.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, so if nothing was happening, you know, if the guys from the newspaper were coming and nothing was going on, then they're like, well, we better do something. Otherwise, everyone will stop coming and then we'll be all left all alone again. And I don't think they wanted that. And, you know, they did interview, I mean, Janet Hodgson is, you know, an older woman now, obviously, but, you know, she doesn't really like to be interviewed much. There are a couple interviews with her out there, but she always seems real uncomfortable when she gets interviewed about it. Now, she did admit that she and her sister had faked about 2% mm-hmm. of the phenomena, but that the rest of it was real. And honestly, a lot of the things and the fact that they were caught faking, that almost kind of makes it more likely that the rest of it wasn't faked. Because if they were faking it all the other times, then they would have caught them, because they caught them those two times, you know, those couple of times where they actually were faking. So they were looking out for that kind of stuff. The parapsychologists were looking out for that kind of stuff. So I kind of feel like, you know, most of the stuff that happened, I really don't think they could have faked that. And while do I think that Janet was producing that Bill voice? Probably, but I don't know if she was doing it consciously, really.
Right. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And The Conjuring 2 has very little to do with what actually happened in that house. And it kind of, you know, trumps the Warrens up as these big paranormal superheroes.
Yeah. And that's kind of a shame. And like I said, I'm not saying that they weren't involved in some legitimate cases, but I definitely do think the Warrens were kind of looking out for number one. So they would sort of, you know, go to a case and then they'd be like, well, how can we, you know, what angle can we get on this so we can get a book out of it and we get maybe get a movie out of it and stuff like that. Because they did, you know, make quite a bit of money from some cases that they worked on. You know, they did that werewolf guy and, you know, Amityville, like I said, and the Smurl haunting, they were involved in that as well. But, you know, it's funny because Enfield, if indeed, as the parapsychologist said, the Warrens showed up uninvited one day and then only stayed there one day and then took off. I'm kind of wondering if they thought, well, it's not our case, or because they met with resistance from the parapsychologists, that they said, well, you know, maybe we should go somewhere else who's more like open to
move
things up, maybe, you know.
Well, with the movie, they I had done some research on the movie, and it looks like it's from the files of Ed and Lorraine Warren or whatever, but they don't actually have the rights to all the stuff that Ed and Lorraine, I don't know. There's something going on where whoever was doing the movies doesn't have the rights to do the movies on most of the stuff. And when you're watching The Conjuring 2, if you know the story behind Enfield, you realize they've just kind of put the Warrens in the positions of the parapsychologists who are actually there.
Right, yeah.
And I think the thing that irked me the most is where Ed Warren, you know, talks to one of the two main parapsychologists there and tells him, this is about the kids. You can't, you know, you can't just treat them like experiments. And I'm thinking, this is coming from Ed Warren.
Yeah, that seems a little, I mean, the thing is, yes, Morris Gross and yes, Guy Lamplaffer, who was the writer that wrote the book about it, you know, yeah, they were there investigating the paranormal activity, but I feel like they also, and from reading their books and watching interviews with them and stuff like that, they did really care a great deal about that family, and they really did want to help them. And I think they both developed a great fondness for the family, and especially the kids. And really, I think the kids almost saw them as like father figures because they had lost theirs. You know, so I didn't really see anything terrible in the way the parapsychologists were. I mean, you know, they were trying to help them. And like you said, that's pretty rich coming from Ed Warren. And I don't imagine that he said anything like that in reaction.
Right. But it's one of those things that ruined the movie for me. I didn't think it was a particularly good movie to begin with, but like every time, you know, they did stuff like that, and it just grinds me the wrong way, you know?
Yeah.
let's see. Let's do one more for now. We're going to have to break this into two parts because I got a bunch of other stuff I want to talk to you about.
Oh, okay.
let's do Humpty Doo.
Okay.
This one's really interesting.
Do you remember what page that's on?
but I can probably find it real quick. Because that was such a strange name for a place, Humpty Doo, Australia.
I know.
It's on page 140. It was in 1998.
Okay, 140. There we go. And this was one. It's funny because I felt like when I was doing the original outline for the book, you know, most of the cases were, you know, U.S., England, you know, a couple from Germany, stuff like that. And I was like, when I uncovered a couple Australian cases, then suddenly, like, the floodgates opened and there was, like, all these other Australian cases. I'm like, wow, it's like, you know, Australia, they speak English. You'd think we would hear more about cases coming from Australia, but we really didn't. But yeah, I did happen to come across this one while I was researching another one. And this is, you know, fairly recent, 1998. And Humpty Doo, I love the name of that town. Australia has, like, the best city names. But it was actually, this was a bunch of housemates. And it was summer of 97. And this couple moved into this house and they had a couple of roommates. And the roommates were also a couple and they had a baby daughter. And then they also had this other friend named Murph, who was kind of a biker guy. And he lived there with them too. Now, the first thing that happened was they were all sitting out on the porch and they were drinking beer when, you know, and talking or whatever. And then all of a sudden, all these rocks started flying at them from out in the dark. And you know, they weren't real big and they looked like the same kind of rocks that were that their driveway was made out of. So, you know, at first they thought, oh, well, someone's out in the woods like throwing rocks at us. You know, but they couldn't find anybody and stuff like that. And eventually they just got annoyed with it. And they said, well, let's just go inside. You know, obviously whoever's out there is just going to keep throwing rocks at us all night. So they went inside the house. Problem was, then the stones started flying around inside the house too. So now the stones are kind of materializing up near the ceiling and then falling down on them. And they said the weirdest thing, it was actually storming outside. But they said the rocks that were falling inside were dry. So they obviously were not coming from outside or weren't coming through the roof or whatever. So, you know, they start investigating. They climb up to the attic. They can't find anything. They just, you know, rocks are falling down on their faces and stuff like that. And then other things started flying around too. Little appliances, a CD player, a mattress, you know, stuff like that. And then they start hearing scratching coming from inside the walls. So the first thing they did was they contacted a priest, and the first priest they called, he was from St. Mary's Cathedral. His name was Father Stephen D'Souza, and he came out and said that someone in the house had latent psychic abilities and that it attracted a spirit. So he's like, well, I'm gonna perform a binding ritual. So, you know, so the spirit, even if it doesn't go away, it won't hurt anyone. So while he's doing the ritual, there was a knife sitting on top of the microwave and it threw itself at him. Now it didn't hit him. It stopped and then fell to the floor. Just like he had a force field around him. So, you know, the priest was like, okay, well, I'm out. Because obviously that didn't work. So even though the poltergeist had thrown a knife at this priest, the poltergeist activity stopped for 3 days after the priest was there. However, it started back again 3 days later. And so then they called out another priest, Father Tom English. He was the second one that came out. And he actually saw a bunch of things flying around in the house, bottles, some bullets. He said he saw things flying around the house and they would turn corners, you know, which is also kind of commonly reported. They call it unnatural trajectory in parapsychology, where things fly around corners or fly around impossible angles. And so he gave the house a blessing. He left them with a crucifix and a Bible. And basically, his blessing did not work either, because he kind of walked back to his car, and then the Bible and the crucifix that he'd left there just went flying up and hit a wall. And, you know, same thing with a bottle of holy water he left there. And the scratching in the wall started getting louder and stuff like that. Now they called in a third priest, who was a Greek Orthodox priest. And he only got about halfway through his blessing before some invisible force started trying to pull the Bible out of his hand and twist his arm behind his back. So he also took off. Now, one of the creepiest things, now, the housemates, they didn't really like all this stuff going on, obviously, but they didn't want to move. It was a nice house. They had all just moved in and, you know, they liked the house where it was and everything like that. And, you know, they said, you know, it hasn't hurt anybody yet, really. You know, so they were kind of interested in them, too, because they said, you know, it's actually kind of neat, even though it's kind of scary. But then it kind of got a little eerier. What the poltergeist would start doing was it would take the pebbles from the driveway and it would arrange them either into little shapes. It would usually do crosses or tridents, or it would spell words. And they said the strangest thing about this was that the pebbles were always arranged with the flat side up. And it's like, and they were always very, very carefully arranged, as though someone had just sat there and taken hours and hours putting these little letters together with these tiny little pebbles. But sometimes it would happen like immediately, like you would walk down a hall and then 2 minutes later you'd walk back down the hall and then there would be a word like spelled on the floor, when obviously no one could have done that quickly.
Right.
Now, the creepiest thing was the words that it was spelling were things like help, car, fire, things like that, which seemed random, but actually the creepy thing, and one of the words that it spelled was Troy. Now, these housemates had actually had a friend named Troy who had, it was spelled differently than the poltergeist spelled it, but their friend Troy had actually recently been killed in a car accident in which his car had caught fire and he had burned alive.
Ugh.
So the odd thing was, though, that even though these words were turning up and they thought, oh, well, maybe it's talking about our friend Troy, you know, about car and fire and stuff like that, but they never thought it was Troy's ghost. They always made the distinction. They thought, well, it's a poltergeist and it's using Troy's death to rattle us.
Mm.
Like it somehow knows about it. Because they said, you know, if it was really the ghost of Troy, it's like, why would he be throwing knives at people? Why, you know, he was our friend. So, you know, he wouldn't do that type of thing and he wouldn't be trying to scare us. But they never believed it was Troy's ghost, even though like all this stuff was kind of relating back to that accident. The poltergeist actually kind of got a little more violent later on. They had a friend over with a little kid, and this friend was talking about, oh, poltergeist, you know, they can do all this stuff, but they can't really hurt anyone, which is a fairly common belief. And evidently, right at that moment, right after she said that, this big pair of pliers like suddenly flew toward her kid who was sitting beside her. And she caught them before they hit the kid. But it was almost like the poltergeist saying, oh, yeah, you think we can't hurt anybody? Well, here you go. The sad thing about this was that the housemates, you know, at this point, the story had started getting around and the media started getting involved. Now, a TV crew came out and they were planning on doing a 2-part series on this show called Today Tonight. And they stayed in the house for several days filming around and they filmed a few like unusual things and stuff. So they were going to do a 2-part show about it. Now, the first part aired and, you know, they're like, wow, we captured some creepy things. And, you know, and it seemed like everyone was real sympathetic to their plight and stuff like that. However, some of the footage that they recorded for the second part, when the producer was watching it, he claimed that in one spot on the video, there was they had actually filmed. There was a big crew there, and they had filmed. I believe it was like a dish or a big bowl or something like that, and it had flown kind of across the room. Now, the producer said that he saw one of the housemates who had been standing in the back. He saw her reflection, like in the front of a stereo or something like that. And she made a movement that made him feel like maybe she had thrown it.
Mm.
But the thing is, you know, the video itself is very vague. And when she watched it back. She's like, no, I was holding the baby and I was leaning over and I was adjusting the baby's clothes because they had become all tangled up. And really, it didn't look like in the video, it's not like she was obviously like slinging her arm out or anything like that. It was just she moved. And so he thought, oh, well, we can't do this now because we're going to be a laughing stock and all this other stuff. So the producer basically said, well, the second part of this show, we're going to make it just all about debunking. We're going to say that it was a hoax. So the second part of the show, they had done all these interviews with a lot of the witnesses and the priests and stuff like that. And they kind of threw all that out. And then they re-recorded interviews with skeptics who thought, you know, oh, these people are faking and all this other kind of stuff. And so the second part really did not do them any favors, because then kind of a lot of the public kind of turned against them and thought, oh, they're a bunch of drug addicts, or they're seeing things and, you know, they're just making things up for attention or something like that, which was, you know, seemed kind of unfair to them because, you know, they seemed like nice people and they complained too. They said, look, we're really not getting anything out of this. And they said, actually quite the contrary, because of all the damage that the poltergeist is causing, their landlord was threatening to kick them out. They had to take him to court. And luckily they got a judge that was, you know, sympathetic and was like, no, they, you know, they're allowed to stay. But they're like, so, you know, it hasn't been a walk in the park. We're not like making millions of dollars or anything like that. Now, the interesting thing, though, is that several members of the TV crew who were there also kind of thought it was a shame, because a lot of them had seen a lot of crazy things going on. And they said the unusual thing, and this is kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about poltergeist not wanting to be filmed, is that at some points they would take everybody out of the house, they would set up all the cameras inside, they would lock it all up, and they wouldn't get anything until all the batteries on the cameras died. All the batteries on the cameras died, some of the crew would go in to change out the batteries, and they would see things flying around inside the house. They would put batteries back in the camera, everything would stop. And they said, and sometimes stuff would start flying around outside where no cameras were. So it's almost like it was deliberately trying not to be filmed.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you know, the sad thing too is that it went on for about 5 months. And like I said, many, many people witnessed it. There were two paranormal investigators who came later. And they actually put it in their book called The Australian Poltergeist. And they wrote about this case among some others, but they actually saw a bunch of things being thrown around the house: pebbles, batteries, bullets, broken glass, knives, things like that. A couple reporters saw it too. I think a reporter from the Sydney Morning Herald came out and he saw stones falling from the roof. And this again relates back to what we were saying before about things being much louder. He said when the stones fell, when they hit the floor, it was much, much louder than it normally should have been. And he also saw pairs of scissors and stuff like that flying around. So, so it went on for 5 months and it eventually just fizzled out. And they really have no idea what could be causing it. They don't think it was the ghost of that friend of theirs. They did speculate that one of the women who lived in the house, the one that had the baby, that maybe she was the focus, even though she was a bit older than the normal one, just because she was the one that was home most often, because the other ones were out at work and she was kind of home taking care of the baby most of the time. And also they thought she might have had some kind of latent psychic ability that had kind of maybe triggered it. But that's pretty much it. Some people have also speculated that maybe Murph, the biker guy, might have been the focus too, because he had been really close friends with Troy, the guy that died, and he had like a lot of unresolved grief and anger issues about Troy dying. So they thought maybe he was the focus, and maybe that was why a lot of the words were coming out of the poltergeist were about the accident. But it's weird because I'd never heard of it before, and that's why I really wanted to include it in the book, because I hadn't heard of it. But it's apparently a very famous case in Australia, like one of the most famous cases in Australia. So I'm kind of glad that I kind of came across it accidentally.
Yeah,
kind of able to put it in the book, because I was like, now that's one that doesn't usually come up, you know, in poltergeist searches.
Hmm. All right. Well, let's stop there for now. We'll continue this on next week's show, because I have at least another show's worth of questions here for you.
Okay. Awesome.
Where can people find you online, and where can they get the book?
Okay. Well, all of my books can be found on Amazon, and all the paranormal ones are available in print, ebook, and in audiobook, if you like audiobook. Also, I have a website, www.jennyashford.com, and that pretty much has links to everything that I do. I also co-host a podcast with Tom Ross, with whom I wrote The Mammoth Mountain Poltergeist. We do a weekly podcast called 13 O'Clock, and we do, some of it's paranormal, but, you know, we do true crime, historical mysteries, just any kind of weird, creepy kind of stuff that we're interested in. And that comes out every Tuesday. And the audio version is on the Project Entertainment Network. And we also have a YouTube channel called 13 O'Clock Podcast.
Nice. All right. And the name of this book is?
This book is called The Unseen Hand. And It's pretty much a compendium of every poltergeist case I could find that I thought was interesting enough to put in a book.
And it's 400 pages, and it's very, very readable and very interesting.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Jenny.
Thank you very much.
All right. And like I said, part two will be up next week. If you're a Patreon, I'm going to have it up for Patreons hopefully sooner. And it may end up being three parts for all I know. We'll see how the second part goes. To take us out, we're going to hear some Eliza Rickman off her album, Oh, You Sinners. This is Pretty Little Head. See you next time. Ooh.
mad, dirty mouth, pretty little hand. I wish you were here, I wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mad, dirty mouth, pretty little hand. But where's your mother? Fall down dead. Dirty mad, dirty mouth, pretty little hand. I wish you were here, I wish you'd make my bed. Dirty mad, dirty mouth, pretty little